strolling through a colonial American village or a 19th century American town, one structure often draws the eye before anything else, the clock tower. Often reaching high above rooftops and marketplaces, these architectural timekeepers have marked the passage of hours for centuries. While we no longer rely on them to schedule our days, their presence is more than nostalgic. It's deeply symbolic, and the clock tower in Carbondale, Pennsylvania, is 5 stories high and part of the imposing city hall that is on the National Register of Historic Places. Clock towers connect us to an era when time was a shared resource, when clocks were heard or seen on the hour from nearly every corner of a town center. Today they stand as reminders of our shared past and of the beauty in building something meant to last. In Carbondale, the materials come from this place, Pennsylvania bluestone and conglomerate rock, the Rock of Ages. These landmarks remind us that time isn't just about minutes and hours, but also about memory, identity, and connection. That from History Facts and the Carbondale Historical Society. We tend to give this clock tower a voice when we say that its clock tells us the time. But the clock tower stands as a symbol, saying so much more about the pioneer city as Carbondale is known, and what the tower represents can be expressed so appropriately in terms of time itself, past, present, and future. We humans often turn to poets among us to bring forth what, in this case, might be the silent significance of this tower that we take for granted as we pass by it each day. Though he is not a poet, but rather a regional entrepreneur and marketing specialist, we turn to Andrew Sod and share what is both a kind of ode to Carbondale and a call to action rooted in the example of those who came before and established the city. This powerful reflection is, as we'll recognize, an ideal prologue for a conversation we're about to have with the producers of a new national documentary titled Amerigo, centering on the American dream. And these producers themselves have invited a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet to take part in their project. And so, here is Sod's sense of the city, its history, and our responsibility as citizens. This is Carbondale. This is northeastern Pennsylvania. This is Main Street, USA. Not as a slogan, as a memory, as responsibility, as identity. There was a time when Carbondale was not spoken about in past tense. It was present, and so was the community. Founded in 1822 by the Wirtz brothers, the first underground mine opened here in 1831. Chartered as a city in 1851, this place did not wait to be discovered. It carved its way into history. Men went underground with lanterns and courage. Women worked in homes, factories, classrooms, hospitals, and churches, steady anchors of families and communities, while industry roared. Children grew up watching parades fill these streets, believing the future lived here. When the community had a need, there were no excuses. Someone showed up. Families built businesses with calloused hands and consistent sacrifice long before stability existed. Immigrant workers arrived with little to nothing and a dream to build something lasting for their families and community. On October 9, 1829, the Delaware and Hudson Canal Railroad, the first operational railroad in America, ran from Carbondale to Honesdale, right here on this ground. This region helped shape the industrial and transportation foundation of the country itself. Rail lines stretched outward from here because this town and region had something worth carrying. Coal and rail moved through this valley, and so did conviction. Main Street and Church Street were not quiet corridors. They were proof. Hundreds of storefronts across this region, mom and pop shops, inns, theaters, restaurants, taverns, bakeries, dress factories, record stores. Not because conditions were easy, because the people here were relentless. Towns like ours helped build this nation. The American dream was never about ease. It was about opportunity, earned through hard work and contribution. The promise, if you showed up, you had a real chance. Look at the old photos. Parades filling the streets, crowds shoulder to shoulder, buildings crafted with pride, storefronts alive with purpose, a community showing up for itself. People did not gather because someone made them. They gathered because they built it with pride, together. Then industry shifted, opportunity moved. People followed for survival, not because they wanted to, because they had families to provide for. There were seasons when Main Street felt quieter than it should have. But pioneers do not disappear when conditions change. They adapt, and something stayed. Identity, memory, blue-collar grit, and people who refuse to let those things disappear. Month after month, year after year, quietly carrying what others sometimes forget. Nothing handed, everything earned. Pride built through work. A reminder that when people show up for their community, pride grows. Neighbors connect, regions strengthen. That is why these stories matter. That is why thousands of locals have stepped forward to connect. That is why pride is strengthening instead of fading. This is not nostalgia. It is continuity. And now something else is happening. I see it in the comments from people sharing their pride. I see it in new signs going up where vacancy once lingered. I see it in storefronts staying open later. I see it in busier streets and fuller parking lots. I see it in families choosing to stay. I see it in neighbors showing up again, because the future is possible. And this community proves it every single time it matters most. Main Street USA was never just about storefronts. It was about people willing to do difficult things for a future they might never personally see. That spirit did not end in the 1800s. It is not buried in the past. It is not locked inside brick facades. It is here. The historical marker for Carbondale is not decoration. It is a reminder that this city began with risk, with vision, with action before guarantees existed, and action still builds cities. What we restore here is becoming a blueprint for other communities, proving what is possible. What we choose to build together now will echo far beyond this community and region. The next chapter is not written by history alone. It is written by those who choose to show up now. If your grandparents walked these streets, if your family worked these mines and trains, if you remember a time when community mattered, if you want your children and the generations ahead to inherit pride instead of apology, if you believe this region still carries that blue-collar spirit and strength beneath the surface, then you understand what is at stake and what is possible. None of this belongs to one person. It belongs to all of us. It is shared inheritance and quiet responsibility. Carbondale, Scranton, all of Northeast PA, founded by builders, forged in risk, still standing, still growing stronger. We have always been pioneers, and pioneers do not move backward. They persevere forward. Words of Andrew Sod, administrator of a Facebook group titled Carbondale PA Connect. And almost by chance, David McCourt and Julie McCourt, producers of the new PBS documentary Amerigo, caught this spirit of Carbondale immediately and so very strongly when they drove off the interstate and began to talk with people on the streets, coming to believe along the way that Mayor Michelle Bannon embodies what they were working to bring out in their film, examining the American dream in our day, Carbondale, a poster child, and that's the phrase they use. The McCourts came to Northeast PA twice to capture the spirit of Carbondale for Amerigo, and when the movie was finished, they came back again to screen the film and take part in a town hall discussion held at the Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine. David McCourt led the conversation, and he was joined by Carbondale Mayor Michelle Bannon and by Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon, who appears in the documentary. WVIA-TV, one of the partnering stations for the project, recorded the town hall, and WVIA will broadcast this PBS documentary, Amerigo, this evening at 7 o'clock, followed at 8:30 by Amerigo in Northeast PA, a community town hall. Before the town hall, David and Julie McCourt paid a visit to the WVIA studios, and they sat down for an art scene interview about their passion project, Amerigo, and how it is rooted in very personal family history.
You tell a story about, and you introduce us to, your grandpa, who came from Galway.
Galway.
When he was 16?
16 years old. He brought everything he owned in one suitcase.
And did you know him?
Oh, I knew him very well, because we all lived together. There were 7 brothers and sisters, 2 parents and 2 grandparents. So the 11 of us ate together. We did everything together. Now, he lived out back in a separate house. He lived in a sort of a one bathroom, one and a half bedroom sort of house where he raised my mother, but he was there every day. He was in my life every day. He's a critical part of my upbringing.
And what stories did he tell about the old country? Did he tell you stories?
Well, he was so proud of, first of all, he was so proud of being an American. And America had offered him everything. He came here at 16 as a janitor, or became a janitor after he came here. And he worked hard every day of his life. And he worked his hands until they were arthritic. And he retired with no educational debt for my mother. He raised my mother. He died with no big medical debt. And he died with no mortgage, owning his own home. And that's what America gave him in exchange for the hard work that he gave America.
And so his model was important to you, just the way he lived his life.
It was critical to watch how someone with nothing could make a life for himself and make a life for my mother, which in turn made a life for 7 brothers and sisters that I have. And each one of us has tried to contribute to America, but we're ordinary. We're not special. The special one was my grandfather.
Did he come to find here others from your family or his family who were here, or did he really just carve out a solo life?
He met his wife that came independently from Galway at roughly the same age, and they met soon after he arrived in America, and they got married and had my mother. His brother was a Christian brother and lived in Chicago, and in those days, you know, Chicago from Boston was a world apart for a blue-collar worker, so they didn't see each other very often. And the rest of his brothers and sisters were still in Ireland. And I think he hesitated to go back because his wife, my grandmother, had come over at the last minute. She wasn't scheduled to come to America. Her best friend got sick and gave her ticket to my grandmother So my grandmother only had 2 days to prepare to leave Ireland to come to America. So she came in on someone else's ticket. So I think that my grandmother was afraid if she left, she might not be able to get back.
In addition to the fortitude that a journey like that takes, it sounds like there's a courage and a sense of faith, and not just religious faith, but you're really casting off and heading into the unknown, even though you might believe that you'll be taken care of. What do you think?
I think in life, you know, you have all these crossroads in life, and you have a choice between the easy road or the meaningful road. And I think he constantly took the meaningful road, which just paid huge dividends for him as a man and as a grandfather for me.
You were little David, and you were in grade school, and you were in high school. How did your education proceed?
Well, you know, in those days, you walked to school, right? So I walked to kindergarten, I walked to grade school, and then I took the bus to high school, and the subway was a little farther away. And you had dreams, like every little kid. My dream was to be a police officer. And then I ended up being a probation officer, the aide. And then I lucked out and ended up building the first competitive phone company in America, which was just lucky. So my whole cop plan didn't work out. But it was just being all together and having that sense of meaning in community really was the foundation that allowed us to have a meaningful life. You know, America is the only country that's not identified by its ethnicity. You'd identify it as an American by a cultural and civic norms and values that make up America. And without them, we're just a place. You're not really an American without those. So those norms and values ran very deep in my family. And I think that helped give us a strong foundation.
You are someone who's been pioneering in the world of telecommunications and communication. You said it was luck that you were able to found that first company, but did you have a sense that if you could do something technologically in terms of helping us connect more readily or more easily, that that could be a contribution to the overall way we live?
Well, you know, a minute ago I said, when you get to a crossroad, you're going to take the easy route or the meaningful route. It's not really defined by hard or easy. It's defined by easy or meaningful. And I probably spent the first 20 years of my life taking the easy route. And then at some point, I decided to take a more meaningful route when I got to a crossroad. And the opportunity to build something that would lower the cost of basic phone service and cable service by about 35% was just a very interesting idea. There's a little over 50,000 named communities in America, and cable and phone rates went up in every one since cable TV and phone service was invented. The first time it ever went down was in Somerville, Massachusetts, where I built the first competitive phone and cable company. It was the first time that rates ever went down. So that was interesting and meaningful.
Were there people, entrepreneurs around you who were trying to cut you off or trying to just do what they did for the bottom line? You always seem to have that sense of community good.
Well, there were lots of people trying to cut us off. They weren't so much entrepreneurs as they were big companies. So when I built that company, we were going up against AT&T. Now, at the time, AT&T was the most profitable company on the planet. Not only the most profitable company in Boston, the most profitable company on the planet. So it was a pretty powerful company, and they said that my phone system was held together with bubblegum and baling wire. So they tried to stop it. And at one point, they got pretty far to stop it, and we started quickly wiring up as many people in underserved neighborhoods as we could, and then we increased our reduction in price from a 35% reduction from the competitor to a 50% reduction. And at one point, I stood up in front of the city council in Boston, and I said, who's going to tell those communities that their phone rates are going to go up by 50%? And nobody wanted that job. So that that helped us. And, you know, almost every business we've undertaken, all the way up to today, we own the fiber optic network in Ireland, and we serve every man, woman, and child in Ireland with a fiber. Ireland has a policy that everybody should have fiber, and their idea is to push jobs out to rural areas where the cost of living is lower, the cost of housing and transportation is cheaper. And the only country in the world doing it that way, which I think is really interesting. But along the way, we set up, you know, a nonprofit, and we gave people a check if they will start a business using that fiber to solve a community problem or create jobs. And we've given 200 of those so far. And every business that we've gone in, we've tried to both make a profit and leave the community better than it was when we got there. It's not that complicated or that hard, to be honest with you.
At what point did your mind start imagining this exploration of the American dream? Because you clearly are a thoughtful person.
No, we started, my co-producer who's sitting next to me, my wife, and I started with a slightly different idea. And like all ideas that come quickly, there's 2 or 3 years of getting it wrong first before it comes quickly. We first were going to do something along the lines of my book, Total Rethink, which was just finding people who have looked at problems differently. And then we thought about doing something around AI and AI for good, because there was so much conversation about how AI was going to create the end of civilization. And then we sort of evolved the idea, and the fundamental premise of how the story is told was all my co-producer's idea.
And so the premise, the question that you made so central, simple, you didn't make it complex. You focused on the American dream. Why? How?
Because I've always been fascinated by, and maybe fascinated is not the right word, maybe troubled is the right word, at how people in my generation have stood on the shoulders of their grandparents, and they were sort of halfway there before they started because of my grandfather or Julie's grandfather that came over here and were extraordinarily brave to do it and allowed us to have everything that we had. And the deal that they had with America is that they would work hard and they would contribute to their community and they would be honest, and America wouldn't leave them with big debts for education or health care. It would make houses affordable to them. And that was a really good deal for both parties. It was good for America and it was good for them. And it allowed us to stand on their shoulders. And if you take half of that equation away, if someone's going to graduate with huge educational debt and never feel like they can ever buy a home, then that changes the foundation of what made America great. And if we want America to be great for the next 250 years, we have to agree that that's not acceptable.
And so you set out, your travelers, you set out on a quest to talk to not just 100 people, not just 500 people, but do we understand 1,000 people, some in every state in the country?
Yeah, and what I think is even more important is that we're launching a website with students down at Miami-Dade College, and we wanted to do it with students because we wanted to make it appealing to young people. Where between this 4th of July and next 4th of July, we're trying to get 1 million voices of people where they'll record their hope for the American dream. And if we can get 1 million people to tell us their hope for the American dream, we'll see that it's not that complicated. And there are a few things that America has to fix if we want the next 250 years to be as rewarding as the last 250 years. So that we're very excited about. And the whole purpose of the documentary is to get people to talk about these issues.
And you're here in our area to lead a discussion, to get things going.
Well, we're here in your area, and we're here at public television because we think public television is critical to democracy. That's the first thing we have to say, because every democracy in the free world has public television. We, before the recent cutbacks, were spending about $1.50, $1.60 per citizen for public TV. Ireland pays $40 per person. England pays $100 per person. We were paying about $1.50, and that was cut to zero. The point is that public TV in a democracy is critical. So we're here to talk about it on public TV because we think that's the purpose, or one of the purposes of public TV is to have these conversations. And I'm not saying, and nowhere in this documentary do we say what someone else's opinion should be. Nowhere do we politicize it. Nowhere do we criticize. Nowhere do we indict anyone. We are simply saying these are the issues and they have to be dealt with if you want this country to be strong for the next 250 years. Usually when people promote a book or a documentary, they go on what's called a speaking tour. We're on a listening tour because we think that if we listen, we will hear that there are some things in America that are broken, and they're not easy to fix, but they have to be fixed. You cannot have a country where service workers can never afford to buy a home. That is not the America that I want to live in.
And so what's wonderful then is you've built into your project not just that we across the country as a public television viewer will be able to watch Amerigo, but the fact is that we then can interact with the website, we can have conversations hosted by our regional public broadcaster, and that's the way that you're bringing us together in community.
We hope so. You know, we hope we have the time to go to as many public TV stations as possible, as many universities as possible, as many communities as possible, to just stimulate this conversation. And I just want to repeat again, we're not coming with an answer. We're not coming to criticize. We're not coming to indict anyone. We're merely coming to say this conversation is critical. And I've heard all the arguments for why we can't lower the cost of housing, why we can't lower the cost of health. I've heard all those arguments. Often, those arguments are made by people who have already realized the American dream. But these problems have to be solved. And people have to understand the problems so that we can have a conversation about them, so we can rally around solving them. Americans are still the most philanthropic. I think from our travels around the world, we think they're the hardest working, most philanthropic, most community-centric, good people. And we just have to help them understand these issues so we can help solve them.
One of the things that is so exciting for us is that you happen to come across Carbondale, Pennsylvania, and the marvelous mayor, Michelle Bannon. Tell us the story about how you all got to meet.
Another partner of ours, Adam Mason, is the director, and he was with us on this tour. And we think that, you know, he decided to get off the exit because he had a father-in-law that lived nearby.
That's it.
We ended up there, and he had no knowledge that I used to live 32 years ago in Wilkes-Barre, and we just ended up here and fell in love with it because...
We went back twice.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. We came back
again. Twice.
And Carbondale, just by the name, you know, tells you what made that town famous. And we just... Look, America, I just want to repeat this. There's over 50,000 named communities in America, and America's not made up of Los Angeles, Boston, Philadelphia, Atlanta, and Chicago, and San Francisco. America's made up over 50,000 named communities that are really important to the people that live there. And those people take huge pride in those communities. And those communities are what makes America great. And those people are the ones that are doing the work that makes America work. So we love coming to places like Carbondale.
And I mean, Michelle Bannon particularly is so encouraging her community to rally together. You know, she's really sort of constituting a blend of humanity there. She's such a cheerleader. Her intention is clear.
Look, there are so many public servants in small parts of America that are working their heart out to make it work. You know, we have on the national level, you know, we have an issue in that there are 22 registered lobbyists per elected official. So if you add up the congressmen and the congresswomen and the senators, there's 22 registered lobbyists for each one of them. And the money is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, which means the influence is more and more concentrated towards corporations and people with money, which is not the way it should be and not the way it can survive long term, but still in small town America, there are public servants that have nothing to do with that federal lobbyist. They're just trying to make their towns work. They're trying to make the fire department work and the police department work, the schools work, and the playgrounds clean and safe.
And third spaces. We came up with this real concept about third spaces, libraries, bowling alleys, people attending church, but then the church thereafter being the bake sale, or the Girl Scouts were in there, or there's a bridge club. You know, it's just the community, sort of the nucleus of the community. And she seems really concentrated on bringing that back to focus. We all grew up with that.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that. So the church that I went to growing up outside of Boston is now condos, but I don't think people realize that in addition to religious services, which you may want to go to or may not want to go to, in addition to that, that's where the AA meetings were. That's where the Boy Scout meetings were. That's where the Girl Scout meetings were. That's where, as Julie said, the bake sales were. That's where the guys got together on Friday afternoon. It's where the ladies got together on Sunday morning. There's a lot of stuff that happened there. There was dances and parties and all sorts of stuff. And that third space is really important to a community. And every time you remove a third space, it may be a church, it may be a bowling alley.
But they have the VFWs.
The Lions Club. The amount of people that belong to a local community has gone down dramatically since 1970 on a straight line. And it needs to be replaced with something.
What did you find when you would be asking and listening? Were they, first of all, surprised that you were interested? Were there those folks who were saying, me, what would I have to say? Or those who would have thought it through carefully and had real suggestions, or felt they really wanted to be active and maybe didn't know how to get going?
I think that people were very willing to talk about it and very happy to be American, very positive about the future, but slightly worried about some of the issues, the divisiveness and the affordability crisis, the mental health crisis. They see these issues and they're worried about them, and they haven't got to the point, at least the people that we saw, hadn't got to the point where they gave up yet, which is good, because it's hard to come back from that. But they've got to the point where they're really concerned that people that have already realized the American dream keep on offering up excuses for why we can't solve these problems. And they feel like these problems have to be solved because we don't have the America that we all love 250 years from now if we don't fix them, if we don't address them.
You know what I found too is the people were so receptive. I mean, with few exceptions, people were like, oh, do you have a moment? You know, it was always very spontaneous. If you were at the end of our arm and you were interested, we did not cast this. We didn't go looking for anybody. Everybody was a candidate. And once they sort of settled in and they, like you said, gave some thought to it, it was like, wait, I want to be heard. I've got something to say here. And, you know, those people are on film. You know, they were so candid. I think, honestly, some of them we met so briefly, we were moving, right? But I love some of those people. When we go through the film together, and we do because we go through every shot, we'll say, oh, I love her. Oh, I love him. I love that look in his eye. Oh, that guy broke my heart. Oh, that one. Oh, yeah. How are they doing? Every single person became very personal to us, right? Which is funny.
You mentioned the putting together of the film. Even if they're short, that's a lot of material to review. Talk to us about your choice of director.
Well, Adam Mason is a very talented director, and we chose him because he had two skills that are different and unique, and we wanted them both. One is he's just a talented filmmaker, but he also had spent a long part of his career in the music video genre, which was important because our other producer, Julie, had spent a long time, and she can tell you about it, in that genre as well. And it was important to us that music helps carry the story throughout this documentary, because so many documentaries, not all, but a lot of them feel like work to watch. They're good and they're helpful and you learn something from them, but you sometimes have to sit down to work to learn that. And sometimes if you've already worked really hard that day, and maybe you even have two jobs to pay the bills, and you get kids that need to be fed, and you get kids that need help with their math homework, and you get kids that need help with their history homework, and you got a spouse that can't find his or her keys or shoes or something, you got life, right? It's a Tuesday and you're living life. You don't want to sit down to work, you want to sit down to entertainment. So we said, how do we make a documentary that's also just raw, good entertainment so that people don't have to feel like it's work, but yet they'll learn something? And again, we pained ourselves to make sure that we didn't indict anyone or blame anyone. We're just telling the audience what these issues are so that we can stimulate a conversation, but we wanted to do it in an entertaining way. And we chose music as the thread that carries you from chapter to chapter. And Julie has a much longer, well, I have no history in music. I just want to be a rock star. I have no ability. I just want to be.
I started in the industry in 1982, and I started as a costume designer. And coincidentally, MTV started around the same time. And I was a costume designer, and I worked... Oh, I did videos after videos after videos. I did Rhythm Nation videos and Michael Jackson videos and Duran Duran videos. So was really indoctrinated into that sort of filmmaking, you know, short form, really entertaining. It has a pace, you know, and we are all very acclimated to taking in information in that kind of short form. And we wanted our documentary to be insightful, but also be very appealing to audiences of all ages. Adam, too, has done lots and lots of videos. He's done lots of films as well. And he's a great storyteller. He was also very brave. In the field, he was very brave. You know, he was able to, well, the three of us, so we're very outgoing. And then as a third, and predominantly it was three and some points four of us, but we're a small crew. Documentaries are made with small crews. And he would walk up to anyone. We would walk up to anyone. We were so in the trenches, and we got so used to it, enjoying it. It was like, wait, I want to talk to her over there. I'm going to go, well, I'm over here. Bring the camera. Who's got the camera? Bring the camera. It was a journey, and it was an unforgettable journey for us. I mean, the gift really was ours. But the music became crucial, and we've tried to put together a soundtrack that is at once nostalgic and then also insightful. And there's, you know, there's a little bit of that sort of good old-fashioned American protest music that has always moved the dial forward traditionally.
What about your theme song?
I wrote a song called Better World, and it's at the end of the film, and there's a bit of it in the middle as well.
You turn your back, I guess you don't care. Ignore those who suffer. To you, it all seems fair. Well, it's your problem too. Step up before your karma catches up with you.
You know, it's my rant on how we all have
need
an obligation
to contribute to a better world.
To a better world. A better world is waiting, but it's up to you. There's a lyric in it that says, "You turn your back. I guess you don't care. Ignore those who suffer. To you, it all seems fair. Clowns are at the wheel and the rest will pay. Protect your heart and soul before they take it away." And that is not at anyone. That is, we've put ourselves in a position in 2026 where it's a very imbalanced world we're living in right now. And so we have to sort of raise our consciousness to care for and about one another.
It's not at anyone, but in the same sentence, we could say it's at everyone, because we're all responsible for the situation
we're
in.
Exactly.
It's not we all have fallen in love with short-term thinking and instant gratification, and we get angry at how much money Jeff Bezos has. But when we need a new pair of shoes, we run to Amazon, and we don't go to the local, you know, the local Main Street shop. And it's not because we don't care about community. It's just that we've got accustomed to being very convenient. And life has gotten very difficult to raise children and multiple jobs and helping them with the homework and getting food prepared. So it's convenient to go to Amazon. So I'm not critical of that. But I'm saying with that, if that's the way we want to live, we have to replace those third spaces, and we have to figure out how to keep community where it is and put community back where it isn't. And we're all responsible, and we can't just keep on blaming other people. We can't just say, oh, we can't build cheaper houses because of regulation. I mean, we built 8.5 million houses from 1940 to 1950, and we had a little side journey to defeat the Nazis while we're at it. So we can get stuff done when we want to. We just have to decide that it's important. And I personally, and I speak for my wife and our entire family when I say this, I think every service worker deserves to live a dignified life. And I think a dignified life includes not having huge educational debt and having homes that are affordable. And there's a way to do that, you know? And we're doing it in Ireland. We're pushing jobs out. We're forcing businesses to put jobs out in areas where homes are more affordable. We have less transportation costs. You have less time in your car away from your family. And the homes are a fraction of the cost. A house in Cleveland is 1/10 the price of a house in New York or San Francisco. But the jobs that people want are in these other places. So we have to figure out how to push jobs out. A home in Cleveland is 1/8 the price of a home in Chicago, LA, or Boston. So we need to embrace these things, but we have to agree what we want the country to look like. You know, one of the great joys in making this documentary is we felt it a huge obligation that we recognize that there were people here for 2,000 years before we started counting our first birthday. So it's, in one respect, it's a little unfair that we're calling it our 250th birthday because there were people here for 2,000 years before us. And we felt like it was critical that we learned as much as we could in a, unfortunately, a short period of time about that. So we went up to George Mason University, and there's a professor there that we met with. And then we went to other Indian tribes and met with other people and other leaders. And we learned about the Haudenosaunees, the Confederation of Tribes, and the Great Law of Peace. And what's really interesting is we stole most of their ideas for our founding fathers, for our Constitution, and in all of our founding paperwork, if you will. Now, we skipped a few parts, like in the Haudenosaunees, women had the right to impeach the chief if he wasn't doing his job, that major decisions have to be by consensus only. And the most fascinating that we learned about is that if you have a major decision, you had to bring it to the chief and explain how that decision would play out for the seventh generation. And if you look at America now, in our first 250 years, people had children at, you know, 18, 19, and 20. So now that people are having kids in the mid-30s, seven generations will be the next 250 years. So we're at our 250th anniversary. Seven generations will take us the next 250 years. So we should be asking ourselves, when we make these policy decisions, how is it going to affect the seventh generation? And if we did a little bit more of that long-term thinking, I think we would be making better decisions. And I think we'd be making fairer decisions. And I think we'd be making more moral decisions. And I'm not, you know, I'm a capitalist. But I think, as my partner taught me, Walter Scott from Omaha, Nebraska, everything in life you touch, you should leave better than before you touched it. And that includes your friends, your family, and your business. Everything you touch, just leave it better than it was before you touched it.
You could have named it anything. Why did you settle on Amerigo?
Because Amerigo Vespucci was the person that America was named after. And he was an explorer. And first of all, I thought it was a great name, Amerigo. But second of all, it was an excuse to start thinking about the fact that this place was here before the Europeans claimed to discover it. You can't discover a place like Mars. I mean, there were people living here for 2,000 years. And, you know, growing up, you know, we played cowboys and Indians, and the cowboys were the brave ones, and the Indians were the savages. And that was not, that's not a fair representation of what was here. So I guess by just putting a pin in the fact that it was named after Amerigo causes us to start to think about, no, it was renamed after Amerigo because it was here first. And I'm not suggesting that we go backwards. It's been 250 years, but we have to pay homage and recognize that there were family-loving, earth-loving, community-loving people, and there were communities as big as London here. And we have to recognize that. And I thought in my mind, by naming it after a European that we renamed America after.
It sparks interest, doesn't it? I mean, people have asked, who's America? What's America? So in answering that question, you create historical reference. And we kind of like that.
You turn your back, I guess you don't care. Ignore those who suffer. To you, it all seems fair. So many hurt. Well, it's your problem too. Step up.
David McCourt and Julie McCourt, producers of the new PBS documentary Amerigo, working in partnership with WVIA, South Florida PBS, Austin PBS, and American Public Television. Amerigo asks everyday citizens, what does the American dream look like today? Amerigo will be broadcast this evening at 7 on WVIA-TV, and it will be followed at 8:30 by Amerigo in Northeast PA, a community town hall recorded in March by WVIA at Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine in Scranton. David McCourt led the discussion, joined by Carbondale Mayor Michelle Bannon and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon. Amerigo at 7 this evening, followed by the town hall at 8:30 on WVIA-TV. A Better World is Waiting by Julie McCourt, the theme song she composed for the PBS documentary Amerigo. Amerigo to be screened this evening on WVIA-TV at 7, followed at 8:30 by Amerigo in Northeast Pennsylvania, a community town hall recorded in March by WVIA at the Geisinger Commonwealth School of Medicine in Scranton. For more information, on the web, WVIA.org, WVIA.org.
Unlock all the doors. Unlock all these doors.